So this is going to serve as mostly a classical introduction to black holes and some of the evolution mechanics that black holes undergo. So heuristically, we can argue for the existence of black holes. So for now, I'm going to call black holes or describe black holes as objects that even light can't escape. And we're going to define that more exactly later on. So a massive object, this is going to be a purely classical heuristic argument, will create a gravitational well with a potential of G M M over R for some small test particle of mass M. To have enough kinetic energy to overcome this potential, we need that 1/2 mv squared is greater than the potential well. So here, that's what defines the escape velocity. Notice that the right-hand side of the equation is unbounded, but the left-hand side of the equation is bounded by the speed of light. So for the escape of light not to be possible, there is a surface at 2gm over c squared where even light can't escape. It's going to be horizon. So intuitively, what we want to define a black hole as a region of space-time where there's no escape. Write that down. These are confusing. Oh, go on, that's it. Sorry. But this definition lacks quite a bit of exactness. For instance, where do you want objects to be able to escape to? There could be several regions separated by horizons, such as in the Kruskal extension. People in our universe cannot escape to the Kruskal extension of the black hole. And also in ADS space, nothing can escape to the boundary of ADS space. It's not asymptotically flat. So this intuitive definition needs some work. But it's a good place to start thinking about. So the exact definition of a horizon is the boundary of the causal past of the future null infinity. Now this is seems like a lot of words at first, but it actually makes sense once you think about it. So I'm going to draw a picture to help deconstruct this. So say we have a Penrose diagram that looks like this, where we have a singularity, and light goes in 45 degree angles, and the light cone is the upward 90 degree angle. That's the light cone, and these are null rays. So if you can try, and this isn't actually a property of the space, it's just sort of, this is a rotationally symmetric thing about this line. So you could think of null rays can travel, this is the past null infinity. Null rays will originate from there, and this is the future null infinity. Light rays will end there. So you could draw several light rays, and they go like that. And you could see that light rays will only reach null infinity if they're in this region over here. So the boundary of, so this is the causal past of the null rays reaching null infinity. So this boundary here is the event horizon. So any null rays going into the event horizon don't reach our future null infinity. Now we're going to look at some examples of black holes. So the most famous example of a black hole solution to Einstein's equation is the Schwarzschild solution, which is the unique spherically symmetric, asymptotically flat solution of the vacuum Einstein field equation with no cosmological constant. So from now on, I'm going to use the units where C and G are 1. The Schwarzschild solution is given by the line element is equal to minus a function of R, dt squared, and then dr squared over that same function. This is the four-dimensional Schwarzschild solution, where f of r is equal to 1 minus 2 m over r, where m is some constant. So this solution is completely determined by the m, which we are going to describe as mass. So this 2m is to reconcile with Newtonian physics, which tells us that, which when they agree at the small mass limit. This solution is asymptotically flat. Which means that as r goes to infinity, ds squared approaches the Minkowski metric. This solution has a time-like killing vector field, which is a telltale sign of a nice black hole that will have some nice evolution property. So. And it's simply given by del by del t. So this time-like killing vector field becomes null. At the event horizon. R is equal to 2m. And space-like, in R less than 2m. The Schwarzschild metric is also singular.
I'm sorry?
Yes?
Can you demonstrate that?
Oh, that it's, sure. So psi mu is equal to the G00 component of the metric, which is equal to minus 1 minus 2m over r.
So the killing vector is the upper index, not the lower index.
So oh, makes sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I like to do it this way, and it's equal to that. Okay. All right. So this is. Less than or equal to 0, less than 0 equals 0, greater 0, when r is greater than 2m, r is equal to 2m, and r is less than 2m. So also just for posterity's sake, what I mean by light-like is that its square is negative. By null, I mean its square is 0, and by space-like, its square is positive. Okay. So the Schwarzschild metric has two singularities in the metric. They're at 2m and at 0. The singularity at 2m is not a true singularity. It is merely a singularity in our choice of coordinates, and that we can extend the space-time to include more regions that GD6 can travel through the singularity. So But the singularity at r equals 0 is a true singularity. There are scalar fields constructed only from the metric that diverge at r equals 0. Which means that there are causal curves reaching r equals 0 in finite affine parameter. And there's no extension to these solutions that will elongate those GOD6. So the extension I was talking about of the Schwarzschild solution is called the Kruskal extension, which includes two normal universes, a white hole solution and a black hole solution. And causal curves can travel from the white hole solution to either universe, and they can travel to the black holes, but not in reverse. So now we can talk about a slightly more general black hole. This is the Kerr solution. So the Kerr black hole is similar to the Schwarzschild black hole, except you're adding rotational angular momentum. So this is the unique, and by unique I mean up to two parameters, which we'll call mass and angular momentum, axisymmetric, solution to Einstein's equations, becomes Schwarzschild when J is 0. So the metric for it is equal to negative delta minus A squared sine squared theta over sigma dt squared minus 2a sine squared theta r squared plus a squared minus delta dt d phi over sigma. Can you see this at the back? Yeah? Okay. Plus r squared plus a squared minus delta a squared sine squared theta sigma sine squared theta d phi squared plus sigma over delta dr squared plus sigma d theta squared. I'll define sigma and delta on another board. Delta is equal to r squared minus 2m r plus a squared. Sigma is equal to r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta. And a is just r j over m, and which we can take without loss of generality to be positive. So it's the absolute, I guess you can call it that, but it's the absolute angular momentum over the mass. There's coordinate singularities. At m plus or minus the square root of m squared minus a squared. And r plus is the event horizon. The Kerr solution has a region outside of the horizon that the time-like Killing vector becomes space-like. So once again, we have that del by del t is a time-like Killing vector field. I shouldn't call it time-like. It's a Killing vector field, which in normal space is time-like. But yeah, in the region bounded by the horizon, and this value is called the ergo region. Or the ergosphere. And it has an interesting property that you can have absolute negative energy within the ergosphere. So you can potentially extract energy from the region by, say, putting a particle inside and blowing it into two pieces, one going in, one coming out. It can leave with more energy than it went in with.
Doesn't that mean that the solution is unstable if you have negative energy?
The energy isn't technically negative, just particles within it will have negative energy. So this time-like Killing vector field, it has a constant of motion that we call energy. And it becomes negative inside the ergo region. But what you're actually doing is you're extracting energy from the angular momentum of the black hole. Want me to go into detail about the energy?
How can you see that it has negative energy?
Okay, I'll. Yeah, it's a really good question. So there is a constant of motion from the Killing equation, which we're going to call energy. So m is the rest mass at spatial infinity, so away from the Kerr solution. And this is a constant of motion from the Killing equation. So we also have that when held fixed, a particle will have its velocity to be purely in the time direction. This is just 1, 0, 0, 0. This is affinely parameterized. Not quite. No, sorry. It's normalized such that x dot squared is negative 1. So we have that the energy for that particle is 0 at the ergo horizon. And it's negative in the ergo region.
X dot me, I mean, C, does C get to depend on T?
Yeah, C is del by del T.
So yes, but C, that its components.
It's not C dot, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, that dot wasn't supposed to be there. Man. It's positive or negative? I think it's plus or minus depending on if it's positive or negative. Sorry, can you see that? So in the ergo region, particles can have this number can be negative. The reason why it's changing between regions is because we're not letting it follow a geodesic. We are holding it fixed and stuff. Is that satisfactory or is that not really?
I'm not sure. It's a bit confusing.
Yeah, I agree.
For example, why do you call that the energy? Well, just class.
I think usually we associate the energy with the constant of motion created by the time-length killing vector field. That's my intuition. That's maybe not correct.
No, I think if you studied that in flat space, you would find that it's exactly. MC or whatever, MC squared over square root of 1 minus C squared over C squared. So in the asymptotic region, that quantity E is the energy, or what we think of in special relativity as the energy of the particle. What you're showing, and it's also true that quantity is a constant for any geodesic motion throughout the space. And I'm not exactly sure the pitch you're trying to make there, but
I guess here, sorry, this is actually to conclude that M is the rest energy. It wasn't actually to say anything about the energy. I don't know why I included it.
Well, but that's sort of, and that's not a geodesic, but it's also sort of a sample of a trajectory that a particle.
It's to give meaning to the coefficient, I think, is all that argument was meant to do.
Okay.
But.
But what I would say is true is, I guess it's not there, but if we study geodesics in general, in this background, what you would find is that, what we would have found in the Schwarzschild solution is that, when you look at particles moving around outside of the black hole, they all have positive energy.
Yeah.
But if I look at particles inside the black hole, because of the way that time and radius have sort of switched roles, you can find particles that have negative energy or particles that have positive energy. What's interesting about the Kerr metric is that you can find particles with negative energy even before you get to the horizon, mm-hmm. and it's because of this dragging effect or because of the ergosphere or the ergo region. But
the region where even space rotates, everything plays around.
So the idea is that there are particles with negative energy in this ergo region, which particles can still escape from. So if you had a particle with energy E, go into the Kerr region, and you detonate something to split into two pieces, E1 and E2, where E1, E2 is equal to E, but such that E2 is less than zero, then E1 will have energy E minus E2, which is more than the energy it went in with. So you could extract energy from the black hole by blowing it into bits, by blowing a massive particle into bits. But like I said before, you're not creating energy, you're just extracting energy from the black hole. So the black hole has angular momentum, so it's a lot of energy to take from.
But, I mean, can't you steal some of its energy anyway? Because, for example, just spaceships going around a planet can steal some of its angular momentum and gain energy. So why would you need to blow to bits anyway?
So you could always extract the rest energy of your particle from the black hole. But the point is that you're extracting it for free. The particle can essentially be gaining energy without losing anything. Like you're not going down a potential well and going up. Well, you are, but for different reasons. You're right, it's just a method of extracting energy that seems unique. You can, let's say you have a particle or a test particle on a string on a pulley, and you lower it slowly into the black hole. You can power things with that. You can extract the energy of the particle, the mass of the particle, by lowering it into the black hole that way. But this is, I'm not sure, is there any lower bounds on the energy in the ergosphere? Probably, like at least the energy of the black hole, but I'm assuming you could extract all of that energy if you wanted to.
Until you get to the extremal black hole.
Sorry?
Well, if it was charged, you can extract energy until you get to the extremal case.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm not including charged black holes, but is that if the charge is more than the rotation? Oh, if it's charged, okay, you can't extract the rotation until J is equal to C or Q?
No, I think you can extract energy until the two horizons get together.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't need to be charged.
I think maximum you can extract 30% or something.
30%?
Yeah, then
cool. Can the energy secretary?
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that makes it interesting is that if you consider relativistically how much energy there is in the system, that a lot of it is in the angular momentum, sort of from a number like that. Whereas if you compare it to a planet, you know, most of the energy is in the rest mass energy. The angular momentum would be a small fraction.
So this is mostly for people who think that once we find a black hole, we'll be able to power things with it. So, and this is saying we can, as long as it's rotating, without, you know, doing a block and pulley system. Okay, so let's move forward. Okay. Sorry, I didn't explain it that well. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the cosmic censorship. So the Kerr solution doesn't on its own preclude the case where M is less than A, which is literally saying that the mass squared is less than the energy. But this would cause the singularity to be naked. Which means that null curves can originate at the horizon. And travel into an allowed region, which means that it would be observable. And so basically,
did you mean singularity?
Yes, yes, it's just, yeah. Yeah. So relativists don't like this. So what they want to do is they want to censor physics and not allow this. So it's so unwanted that they're calling this a conjecture. And so a lot of the uniqueness theorems and evolution theorems depend on this conjecture. So they'll promote this idea of no naked singularities to a conjecture. So basically, they're going to prudishly clothe singularities with event horizons. So you'll never see a singularity without a horizon around it. And this just makes the physics a lot nicer because we don't have to worry about our geodesics ending. Once they cross the horizon, we rarely care about what they do next.
I don't know that it's so much that the relativists are prudish as experience seems to show us that Einstein's gravity makes it hard. If you don't have a singularity and you have reasonable matter and the system evolves, it just doesn't make naked singularities.
You're right. So another way of saying it is that naked singularities may be extremely unstable and that they don't exist anymore. Nothing can evolve to a naked singularity.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have the sentence with the unstable in there, but it's true. Yeah, it's the system. Einstein's gravity doesn't take you to naked singularities, which makes it hard.
I'm not sure. I mean, the simulations that that Louis Lehner, for example, did. I mean, he gets it's not in four dimensions, but he gets naked singularities from evolution of blasting.
Yeah. Well.
So I guess this conjecture is from classical GR.
It's also true that there are other examples, but they're very esoteric, very you know, as far, I mean, one of the, as far as four-dimensional physics and describing cosmology or astrophysics, the reason we get to use Einstein's equations is because, you know, rather than finding naked singularities where we couldn't do physics or we need some new physics,
mm-hmm.
you get to use Einstein's equations. I think many relativists would be delighted if you got to see naked singularities, because then you could just look and try and observe whatever quantum gravity. But in any event, that's all I'm saying.
So they're not crudes by choice. It's forced on them.
Yeah.
Well, there won't be nothing, right?
Sorry?
And if there was a naked singularity, you won't see nothing.
You would see what replaces Einstein's equations. The singularity means that Einstein's equations have broken down.
You could still do that. I mean, and you can think of an experiment in quantum gravity where you fall into the black hole and observe what goes on.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're not getting back to that.
But that's what grad students do.
So this gives the Kerr solution. Bound on the angular momentum. So now I'm going to go into the uniqueness of black holes, which I should mention only really hold in four dimensions. And with suitable hypothesis. So it states that a stationary black hole is completely determined by mass, angular momentum, and the long-range forces. So an example is the electric charge. In addition to this uniqueness theorem is that excited black holes will tend to evolve into stationary ones. So another way of thinking about this is that equilibrium solutions are unique given mass, angular momentum, and charge. But the excited solutions can move around and evolve and eventually, over time, end up at one of these stationary solutions. In asymptotically flat space, it's possible that through evolution, it'll completely evaporate and radiate away. So it's possible for black holes to disappear over time, losing their energy to infinity through radiation. We're going to go on to the area of black holes and black hole mechanics. Okay, so if we have the null energy condition, sorry, I should name this theorem. So it's still going to be written down, so if you've already started writing, it's not a big deal. This is called Hawking's area theorem. Also known as the second law of black hole mechanics. So, if we have the null energy condition, that is to say that this quantity is non-negative for all null vectors. And assuming...
Did you want that to be contracted with another?
Yeah. Sorry. Two of these guys. Thanks. And assuming the cosmic censorship. Conjecture.
Is that larger or equal to zero?
It's larger than or equal to zero. It's non-negative condition.
Okay.
Then the area of a black hole horizon is non-decreasing over time. I've actually always been a little confused about the overtime part, since time seems to be a little ill-defined for a space-like object. Can we parameterize all points in the horizon at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure what was the question though. Say that again.
It says, like, I've read this a few times, it the horizon always increases over time.
Yeah.
Is this through all observers seeing the horizon? Is it just a mathematical property?
We haven't seen, you had one Penrose diagram over there, and so the horizon itself is a null surface. It has codimension 1. But what you're doing when you measure the area is you take a slice through that horizon or through that surface, and you're asking, you know, on subsequent slices, is the area getting bigger or smaller?
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So it's slices of T, then, of our...
Well, T wouldn't, like in a Schwarzschild black hole, T wouldn't be a good way to slice the horizon.
Okay.
Isn't that just a statement that the horizon is constant unless, say, you merge two black holes and then the horizon will be the sum of the two? I mean, I don't think that's anything, dynamics or anything over time.
Yeah, it is. The reason it's the null energy condition is because black holes, stuff falls in all the time.
Oh, you mean, okay, yeah. Fine, all right.
And
but that doesn't have anything to do with the geodesics and going always and being always closer to each other.
That's how it's.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. That what you really study is actually the divergence, how rapidly they're separating.
Okay.
And so actually locally on each little patch of the horizon, if you follow them with how they go up with null rays, each little patch itself is getting bigger.
Okay.
Well, it's either stationary or it's bigger if stuff falls through that little patch.
Okay. So I'm just going to offer a small sketch of the proof.
Oh, okay.
Which is just basically what Dr. Myers just said. For an area element, of the event horizon, there's a property that the area element's evolution over its affine parameter is proportional to the area element, and this coefficient is called the expansion. So if theta is greater than, sorry, if theta is less than zero, then geodesics must converge to a focus or a caustic. Either way, it produces conjugate points.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
Here, when you mean event horizon, the event horizon is only defined at infinity, right? So should it be some local horizon, or like a Keeling horizon?
I think my event horizon is a spatial null surface.
Okay, then it's your Keeling.
Sorry, it's a null surface.
I think
it's a spatial surface generated by null Keeling vectors.
So it's a Keeling horizon.
Okay, yeah. Sorry.
No, it doesn't have to be. If it's Keeling horizon, nothing much is going to be happening. But formally, when they prove these things, at least in the first versions of the proof, they were actually looking at the real global event horizon.
Okay. But how can you say that the event horizon area is increasing if the event horizon is only defined at infinity? I mean, you can only it's a global measure.
No. You're talking sort of about this teleological character of the horizon, that I have to follow the space-time all the way to the future to figure out how to trace it backward, sort of along the line. But you can still ask, okay, now I have the horizon, and so I understand the evolution of the entire space-time, I know where the horizon is in that space-time, and I can ask how it was evolving, or how it changed as we move forward in the evolution. You seem skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that I think
Nemo wants to add something.
would that require a global hyperbolicity?
It probably would, yes.
So the sketch talks about just a single element of the horizon, and I guess you could measure if that area element is getting bigger or smaller. So I guess it's treating each point of the horizon and looking at its world line. And if the congruence class has conjugate points or not. So if it does, then then it's shrinking. If it doesn't, then it's expanding or staying still. So the sketch goes that if the expansion is negative, then there's conjugate points, but Penrose says this is not allowed. So we say that theta has to be bigger than zero. And so our differential area element is always increasing. Well, that was very sketchy, and I didn't follow it very much myself, but I thought I would reproduce it here anyway. Yes?
Sorry, on that second line, you write something next to theta. And I
smaller than zero.
Okay, but on the left side of it? If.
Oh, if.
Yeah,
say
like,
suppose.
Looks like my
book. Okay. Yes.
Quickly. If it does indeed assume that the manifold is globally hyperbolic, I think it does, then it sort of answers the question earlier, which is how would you define in time? But if it's globally hyperbolic, then you're guaranteed to be able to Fourier the space in special instructions. So if time in some sense is.
I don't think I'm capable of answering that question. I don't know what global
it's
hyperbolic.
It was a comment, not a question.
Oh, it's a comment. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then, good. Yes.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Todd. I don't really understand what you're saying there.
Okay. How about that?
You're saying geodesics must focus.
Why I'm saying that if the expansion parameter is negative, then the geodesics must focus, yes.
But doesn't that happen anyway?
No, not the... These are the geodesics... of the horizon test particle, which are null. You always want, you don't want them to be coming towards each other, you want them to be going away from each other. You want the horizon to be getting bigger. So it supposes that first theta is negative, and that gives it the intuitive impression that that would cause the area elements to collide.
Okay.
Over their world lines would meet again. I can
world
only give
lines
an.
Lines trapped on the surface.
So they're on the surface of the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to sort of emulate the horizon itself.
Mm-hmm.
So these test particles. I suppose two test particles at the same point in space-time could, at some later point in their affine parameter, meet again.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that just like saying that if the horizon gets smaller eventually, it'll become a point?
They might not all, it might not be a focus, it could be a caustic, so it could be several points colliding at some points and others at other points. I'm not sure if it implies a point. But the idea, I think, is that that's, it's not allowed for even for any of these null conjugate points to exist.
Yeah, I think rather than thinking of test particles, usually what you think of is you built this horizon and you know it's delineated by null geodesics, so you can think of those geodesics as the generator, or often that's the, they're called the generators of the horizon. And I have to confess, I'm not familiar exactly with what's behind there, but I think the idea is that caustics are associated with space-time singularities. But if the hypothesis was that their space-time singularities are always behind the horizon, then that won't happen. And so theta has to be bigger than or equal to zero, and you have to avoid the situation. But again, I'm not sure precisely.
It's not to do with space-time singularities. You can certainly have geodesics, like a geodesics that, you know, form a congruence of geodesics that form caustics that's not at a space-time singularity. It's just that you can show that if you have, you have to use this sort of future boundary condition at this point, and that's what says that you can't form caustics. That if you have a past, you know, basically that these light rays sort of have to, they have to make it to sort of future null infinity, and if they sort of cross each other, then they can sort of leave the horizon, and they would no longer be the boundary of the past of some set.
I think part of the argument was that the fact that there's conjugate points means that there's light lake separations between these null generators, and that would cause it to be included in the null past infinity.
Yeah, that sounds right. So it's just sort of because you're considering this very special type of surface.
Yeah, that is defined as the boundary of the causal past of the future null infinity.
Right. Like a sort of to see why you need that assumption, you could just consider a point, say in Minkowski space, and look at the boundary of its past.
Okay.
And that, in many ways, looks like a horizon. It's a null surface, but of course, it's getting small. It's, you know, it's the past light cone. It's shrinking. So theta is negative, and the reason that the theorem it does end in a caustic.
Okay.
So, you know, the theorem is not, that's the case sort of where the theorem doesn't apply.
Yeah. It's
but it shows why you need this future boundary condition.
It's something special about these geodesics that they have to be the horizon.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's really good insight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we're all completely agree that this is true. So we'll move on. And I'll state the zeroth law of black hole mechanics. So it's stated that if the dominant energy condition holds, which states that vector is causal, whenever psi is causal, then the surface gravity is constant throughout the horizon.
What do you mean by causal? I'm not for lecture.
Yeah, sorry. I'll be using the word causal to save time, I think. this is null. And null is light, like. Okay, proof. It's going to include a step that I'm not going to prove here, so just be prepared for that. So we're going to let psi to be the generators. Sorry, to be the generator of the horizon. It's a killing vector. So one property of killing generators of horizons is that this scalar is zero. That implies that this scalar, which for null vectors is proportional to that scalar there that I just wrote down because of the Einstein field equation, it's not zero yet, but it's null. So that goes away, and this goes away from that property. So we have that that scalar is null. And I'm going to let j mu be equal to t mu nu psi nu. So that an easy property to see is that it's orthogonal to the generators of the killing horizon, of the killing vector.
Sure. What's surface gravity?
Oh. One definition is that if you are happy with the horizon being generated by a killing vector, that it's equal to this. Or it's defined by this. There's several ways of defining it. Not sure what's a good intuitive grasp at it.
Acceleration. It's the image of acceleration of near the horizon. You have a Rindler space, and I would say it's the image of acceleration of the Rindler space. What
they think? That's fine. I wanted to just visit it. Somewhere in your theorem, as you stated it, you should say something like stationary black hole or killing horizon. I mean, it's clear that when you go into the proof right away that you're talking about the horizon generators being killing vectors, but it's important then to state that what we're talking about here are stationary black holes, or maybe you did and you didn't write it on the board.
It's probably supposed to be stationary. I agree with that.
All of the black hole mechanics will be holding for stationary effect. Not necessarily for the other ones.
Well, that's not entirely true in that if you talk about the second law, you're talking about something.
And what do you want me to amend with the killing?
No, I just want the word stationary there somewhere.
So the existence of a time-like killing vector field.
Well, yeah, you're assuming that the horizon's a killing horizon.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
so I have...
If I could just make a comment about surface gravity. I think the simplest way to think about it is you have a particle of mass m on some string or something, and you want to lower it as close as you can to the horizon. You have to, in order to hold it in place, you need a force F that you apply at infinity. And the surface gravity is just the thing that plays the role of the acceleration. It's the ratio of force to mass to keep it to keep the thing hovering right outside the horizon.
Cool. All right. So we have that J is orthogonal to the Killing vector. Which means that we can, letting eta 1 and eta 2 be a basis for the horizon, so they're orthonormal. This means that J is a linear combination of xi eta 1 and eta 2. But since eta 1 and eta 2 are tangent to the horizon, we have that they're orthogonal to xi. Which means that j dot j is b squared plus c squared. I should have mentioned that b and c are real numbers. So b squared and c squared are both positive, or non-negative, I should say. So j dot j is bigger than or equal to 0, but j mu is equal to t mu nu xi nu, which by, is it the dominant energy? The dominant energy. Condition T mu nu xi nu must be causal. That means that J mu dot J mu has to be less than or equal to 0. So these two imply that j dot j is 0, which in turn imply that b equals 0 and c equals 0. And so j is proportional to our Killing vector.
By causal, yes. You mean timeline code a node?
Yes.
Also node included, right?
Yes. Okay. So just non-space-like. Okay, so that means that this equation is true by the Killing equation. And so bringing back what we mean and using the symmetry of our stress energy tensor, we have those are equal. The Einstein field equations let us bring in the Ricci tensor. Which is equal to this, which I won't prove, but it's true. Which means that the derivative of our surface gravity is proportional to our Killing vector field. And so in turn, that means that for every tangent vector, our surface gravity is constant along it. So besides the one, I should have a note here so your notes aren't, you're going crazy. So can you read what I wrote here? true but not proven here. I sometimes forget that you're not standing 2 inches from the board like me. So that's the zeroth law. Are there any questions? So it's essentially saying that the surface gravity is a property of the entire black hole, not just of each point on the horizon. And I'm sure they do mean stationary, because I'm sure excited black holes have fluctuating surface gravities. Move on to the first law. Okay. If a stationary black hole of mass m angular momentum j and charge electric charge Q with a future event horizon H with surface gravity kappa. Electric surface potential phi h and angular velocity omega h. if this black hole is perturbed, another stationary black hole with mass m plus delta m, angular velocity j plus delta j, and charge q plus delta q, then right over here we have essentially an equation of state. dm is equal to the surface gravity over 8 pi dA plus the angular velocity dj plus the electric surface potential times the differential charge element. So this would be, say you throw an object into the black hole with mass delta m, angular velocity delta j, and charge delta q. This is what the new black hole, well, this is how it will evolve. I realize that I changed the differential elements, but I guess the point is if they're small enough, you could replace all these with delta m, delta a, delta j, delta q. So I'll prove the chargeless case. So the uniqueness theorem implies that for any m and j, A is determined. And what this theorem does is it reverses the role of A and M and says that implicitly M is determined by A and J. But since the units of A and J are that of M squared, remember, this is GR dimensions, so C and G are the same, so mass and distance are the same. The function MAJ must obey this equation. This is Euler's theorem for homogeneous functions. So mass from Smar's formula is equal to this. Which mean that A times the partial of M with A minus kappa over 8 pi plus J times the partial of M with J minus the angular velocity has to be 0. But A and J can vary independently. So partial of M with A is equal to kappa over 8 pi, and the partial of M J is equal to the angular velocity. And so if you put those partials back into that differential equation, you'll get the desired result. So I've already talked about how to extract energy from a black hole. So that was sort of the optional last part. So I'll ask, does anybody have any questions?
Could you lower that board again, please?
Sure. Sorry. Dr. Myers wants to ask something. No?
No.
I don't like that argument either, but I think it's the Euler theorem, I think it's about if A and J are completely independent of each other, then that equation has to be satisfied.
This is just the chain rule, right?
No.
It's a dimensional argument, though, so I'm not sure. I'm sure there's alternatives to this proof. This is just the one that I dug up.
Now that you mentioned that, I know that you can go. I mean, the way you described it is, and what your proof relies on, is they're taking a stationary black hole to another stationary black hole. I know that there is the derivation of something called Wald's entropy actually shows you that if you have a stationary black hole, i.e. one with a Killing horizon, and you perturb to any nearby solution, that you'll have a formula like that with appropriate definitions of.
So you think I could remove this stationary for the endpoint?
Not the way you described it, but yeah, in principle, there is a version of it that lets you go away from stationary to endpoint. But I have to confess, I don't remember all the details. Anyway, that's fine.
Okay.